on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is February Friday 24th. I'm Morgan Yee, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our podcast on the internet at citr.ca. Good evening. It is 5:02 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your local, provincial, and national headlines. The man who stabbed a senior at a coffee shop this Tuesday has been charged with attempted murder. Mohammed Amr, 30, was charged after he stabbed a 71-year-old man in broad daylight at a Waves coffee shop on the corner of West Hastings and Richard Street. The senior, who suffered major injuries, is in critical but stable condition. Amr has a history of violence and property-related crimes across Canada, said a police representative, and was apprehended twice by the Vancouver Police Department on the 21st of this month under the Mental Health Act. Amr was scheduled to appear in court yesterday and remains in custody. Today, gas prices in the Lower Mainland jumped to $1.40 a litre overnight. This is because of the continuing surge in prices, which started a week ago. Experts say Lower Mainland drivers are feeling pain at the pumps because of a fire-damaged shutdown that continues at the BP Cherry Point Refinery in Blaine, Washington. Quote, "Tightness of supply in Vancouver is associated with the disruption of supply at Cherry Point," unquote, said industry expert Michael Irvin. Quote, "The good news for Vancouverites is that when Cherry Point gets up and running, and it's hard to say when, the premium for wholesale prices will return to normal levels," unquote. There is no estimated date for production to resume to full capacity at the Cherry Point refinery. An RCMP Code of Conduct hearing is recommending that a female officer be docked 7 days' pay and continue counseling after the hearing concluded she had consensual sex with her supervisor. Constable Susan Gastaldo claimed that she had been forced into the affair with her boss, but the tribunal found that it was, in fact, consensual. Staff Sergeant Travis Pearson, the other party involved, has already been reprimanded and docked 10 days' pay by the same panel after admitting to the affair and sending suggestive emails. Gastaldo fought against the accusation, claiming she was coerced and sexually assaulted on more than one occasion. The panel, however, did not believe her. Last December, the board ruled that Gastaldo, who has an anxiety disorder, was not truthful nor plausible, and that she was simply trying to cover up the fact that she had been having an affair. Quote, "The board isn't convinced that a person who has been sexually assaulted would readily communicate with their assailant," board chairman John Reed said in his ruling. Records show the pair spoke for a total of 48 hours over a three-month period and exchanged 160 email messages, many of them romantic or sexual in nature. BC's 40,000 teachers will hold a day of action this Monday to consider the provincial government's plan to legislate an end to their contract negotiations. Susan Lambert, president of the BCTF, says this will not affect classes, as teachers will be spending only their lunch breaks discussing the issue. The negotiations have been ongoing since September. This day of action comes after Education Minister George Abbott announced yesterday that legislation which would stop the job action, which has included teachers not completing report cards, would be discussed next week. The Canadian Avalanche Centre has extended its special public avalanche warning to include mountain ranges on the northwest coast as the risk of slides increases. The warning now includes the Cariboos, the North and South Columbias, Kootenay Boundary, the North and South Rockies, the Lizard Range, the Purcells, the South Coast Inland, Northwest Coastal and Northwest Inland regions. Anyone on the slopes is advised to stay clear of avalanche terrain this weekend as conditions are, quote, very tricky to manage right now, end quote. The Crown has approved charges against five more people who were involved in the Stanley Cup riot last year. The total number of people charged now stands at 57, with these 57 facing 153 charges, including participating in a riot and mischief. The Crown is still working to process the 125 people investigators have recommended charges be laid against. The first person to be convicted was 20-year-old Ryan Dickinson, who was sentenced to 17 months in jail last week. And those are your local, provincial, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned to CITR's 101 for weather and international news, courtesy of FSRN.org.
School feels so hectic right now. I really need a break.
Do you ever wonder if traveling can actually enhance your education?
Yeah. How?
Easy. With the Study and Go Abroad Fair, you can find information on semesters or degree programs abroad, working, volunteering, and even adventure travel.
Just what I need, when and where.
March 1st at the Vancouver Convention Center. Doors are at 3, but guest speakers start at 2. Admission is free, and you'll be entered to win a trip to Guatemala, Peru, or even an iPad.
What's the website?
Go to studyandgoabroad.com for more information and to pre-register.
WCCMC West Coast College.
Their new 20-month program is set to launch in May, so not only will you be receiving the best massage therapy education in the world, but you'll also be working faster as a registered massage therapist. Start a meaningful career and enjoy an almost 100% employment rate. Get more details today on how to become a registered massage therapist in only 20 months.
WCCMT.
Visit collegeofmassage.com.
Born in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Faith Nolan is an award-winning singer-songwriter, film producer, and ardent advocate for social justice. Her music and politics are one and the same, both firmly entrenched in her experiences as a queer woman of African, Mi'kmaq, and Irish heritage, raised in the working-class neighborhood of Regent Park, Toronto. Over the course of her career as a musician, she has recorded 14 albums, the most recent of which, Hang On Cupe, was released in 2009. For more information about the Queering Black History 2011 recipient, Faith Nolan, go to her website at www.faithnolan.org. And now, a selection from Faith's music, a track titled, Where Can I Run?
Where can I run? Where can I hide? You stole my body, now you're torturing my mind. You come in the night. When my eyes close, scream and run for my life, you're the nightmare in
this PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee, and you're listening to a live broadcast of Independent News from UBC. Now we have your local weather forecast for this weekend. It would be brought to you usually by Phil from the UBC Storm Club, but he is not here today, so you get the news from me. Or the weather, rather. Today, snow or rain changing to rain near noon, which we have all experienced. The rainfall amount to about 15 to 25 millimeters. The locally snowfall around 2 centimeters over higher terrain. Wind is eastward at 30 kilometers an hour, except where it's southeast 60 kilometers near the water, and there's a high of 6. Tonight, we can expect showers of up to 10 millimeters. Wind southbound 30 kilometers an hour, becoming northwest 60 kilometers an hour, gusting up to 80 kilometers an hour overnight, and a low of +5. Saturday is going to be mainly cloudy. There's a 30% chance of showers in the morning with winds gusting up to 60 kilometers an hour in the morning and up to 80, but lowering to 60 in the early afternoon with a high of 6. And Sunday, we can expect a mix of sun and clouds with 40% chance of flurries, a low of plus 3, and a high of plus 3. And that was your local forecast. And now we're going to go to fsrn.org for our international headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The Friends of Syria, a group of Western and Arab leaders seeking a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Syria, are expected to call on the UN today to send a peacekeeping mission to the country to help quell the violence. Officials are also demanding a ceasefire so humanitarian aid can be delivered. Secretary General of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Ekmeleddin Insanoglu, told The Guardian that stopping bloodshed in the country is the goal.
Expecting and asking for the ceasefire is a prerequisite for a peaceful solution.
The meeting, held today in Tunisia, was greeted by pro-Assad protesters. Meanwhile, protests and government sieges continued across Syria today. Video posted on YouTube shows hundreds at a rally in Daraa. According to activists, the chants translate as, "O Homs, we are with you until death." Other videos show dead bodies and heavy military patrols. Reports from the ground say military sweeps continue with civilians being arrested in central Damascus. Shelling by security forces continued in Homs today as well. A member of the opposition told Reuters that the Free Syrian Army, composed of defected members of the military, has begun receiving small arms from several different sources. Families of the victims of last week's prison fire in Honduras are still waiting for their loved ones to be identified by authorities. As of yesterday, only a few dozen of the approximately 350 dead inmates had been identified. Family members have been camped out on mattresses outside the morgue, kept out by a chain-link fence. Several spoke to FSRN reporter Irene Rodriguez. Ingris Echevarria is among those waiting.
They read out the names, and at times they only list one name. We are told we will have to wait. Who knows how many days?
The smell from the morgue is so strong that many wear masks. Family members, including Echevarria, are also angry because of what they perceive as a cover-up by prison officials. They say many of the inmates were shot.
Forensic medicine wants to cover up the situation in one swoop, but they can't. On Monday, we entered with the military, and we could see the bodies thrown in the streets like animals. Some family members opened the body bags and could see that some bodies had been shot.
Families are also questioning the official story on how the fire was started. Reina Rivera's son was in the prison.
Everyone knows it wasn't an accident. They were killed. They are shot and they are burned. A candle doesn't cause that much destruction on three or four levels. Maybe a small area, but not that great of an area. It's a disgrace that those who are supposedly investigating are lying as well, along with the prosecutor. It was an assassination. We know because we are familiar with that prison.
On Tuesday, U.S. Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau investigators confirmed a Honduran government claim that the fire was likely caused by an open flame. Supporters of marriage equality are celebrating a victory today after the Maryland Senate voted last night to approve a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. The governor has vowed to sign. FSRN's Clayton Kahn reports from Baltimore.
On a 25-22 vote, Senate lawmakers approved the same-sex marriage measure that had narrowly passed the Maryland House last week. Many reports have named African-American faith communities as the strongest opponents of the bill. However, Jody Kelber Kay, an activist within the LGBT community, says that's simply not true.
It's been a fair amount of misinformation about black churches and their influence. And there are some regions where there are some black churches who do have a fair amount of influence, but there's just as many white churches who have a fair amount of influence. It really just depends on where you are in the state.
Opponents of the legislation say they intend to gather signatures to place a referendum on the November ballot. For Kelber Kay, this process is disheartening.
You know, it's never a good idea, as you know, for a majority to vote on the rights of a minority. It's sort of, that's why democracy is there, is to protect minorities from those kinds of actions. So it is disheartening that we still have some freedom in the Maryland Constitution for civil rights to be up for referendum.
Governor Martin O'Malley is expected to sign the bill in the coming week. Supporters are vowing to fight any referendum effort. Clayton Kahn, FSRN, Baltimore.
Republican lawmakers in Virginia have launched several consecutive attacks on women's and gay rights. Many measures have won approval, but the Virginia Senate has decided not to pursue personhood legislation. Amid intense criticism and mounting protests, the Senate voted to put off the measure until next year. The bill, which establishes that human life begins at the moment of conception, is one of several measures being pushed to the legislature that attempts to limit abortion rights guaranteed by the Supreme Court. And that's headlines for FSRN from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
Dozens of people with disabilities have clashed with police in the city of La Paz. Many of the demonstrators traveled nearly 1,000 miles to reach the capital and stage their protest, some of them using crutches or wheelchairs. But the peaceful protest turned violent when demonstrators confronted a line of riot police. As scuffles broke out, a mother of one of the protesters appealed to the police cordon.
Why should a mother suffer so much? You have no hearts. Please, brothers, let them pass through.
Protesters made the three-month-long journey to La Paz to demand an increase to their annual state subsidy from $85 to $400.
What we're demanding as people with disabilities is equal treatment. We're Bolivians, not foreigners. We have the right to go into Murillo Plaza. We want Congress to approve the preferential treatment law as we've set out. We want them to take that into account.
Sound courtesy of the BBC. Several protesters were hurt when riot police used pepper spray to stop the demonstrators from entering the presidential square. The Guardian reports that some of the protesters started a hunger strike and 24-hour vigil. The European Union's efforts to combat global warming are increasingly angering other countries, including the US. These countries and their powerful industries are now pressuring EU officials to weaken or abandon some of the strongest climate policies in the world. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
On Wednesday, government and industry representatives from the US, China, India, and more than 20 other countries wrapped up a two-day meeting in Moscow. The purpose of the meeting? To devise ways to punish the European Union for making foreign airlines take part in the EU carbon emissions market. All commercial flights into or out of European airports now will have to pay for carbon emissions that exceed strict EU limits. After the meeting, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner told reporters in Washington that Europe needs to back off.
We believe that the EU needs to cease application of this scheme to foreign airlines and engage meaningfully with the International Civil Aviation Organization to find and develop a global approach to this problem.
Participants at the Moscow meeting came away with a raft of retaliatory measures to make life harder and more expensive for European airlines, including fees for use of foreign airspace and restrictions on flight corridors and landing privileges. So far, Europe isn't backing down. EU spokesperson Isaac Valero Ladron notes that the EU went ahead on its own only after more than a decade of negotiations on a global plan for cutting aviation emissions went nowhere.
Rather than asking us for the suspension of the only functioning system that exists to address aviation carbon emissions, these countries criticizing the EU should come forward with concrete and constructive proposals.
In the meanwhile, Valero Ladron says the EU law will stand, and air carriers that don't play ball can be fined or even denied access to European airports. The day after the Moscow meeting, foreign pressure prevented another EU climate law from going forward. As part of the EU's cap-and-trade carbon market, all fossil fuels are given a rating based on their greenhouse gas impact. Citing studies that show fuels derived from tar sands have a carbon footprint about 22% bigger than conventional oil, the EU planned to reflect that in tar sand oil's carbon rating. This week, documents surfaced that reveal an intensive Canadian campaign to block the tar sands rating. When the EU's Isaac Valero-Ladrin was repeatedly pressed by reporters to describe the Canadian pressure, he resorted to diplomatic clichés.
We had a constructive and continued dialogue with the Canadian authorities, and we received some letters, and we had exchange of letters.
But Nusa Urbancic with Transport and Environment, one of the NGOs that used public records requests to uncover the documents, says Canada has been going all out to kill the tar sands rating.
These documents show that the Commission was under a lot of pressure, and it also shows that this pressure is now continuing at the national level of different EU countries.
Canada has linked the tar sands issue to renewal of the free trade agreement between Canada and the EU, currently being negotiated. Canadian officials have warned of possible trade retaliation, repeatedly insisting they will defend Canada's interests. In a crucial vote Thursday, the EU failed to pass the fuel quality ratings, postponing the decision for further consideration. Nearly all governments say that global warming is a serious threat, and they accept the scientific findings that greenhouse gas emissions have to be slashed dramatically and soon to head off catastrophic climate change. So why are so many of them treating Europe like a stubborn child?
It's my firm belief that the European Union is actually acting responsibly at this point in time.
Thomas Fergerman heads Consinto, a Copenhagen-based green think tank. He says the pushback against EU climate policy comes largely from countries clinging to what he calls sundown industries, industries based on fossil fuels and other dwindling natural resources. Fergerman says that, as the world's largest economy, Europe is in a position to model a more sustainable approach.
The European perception is that green growth is the answer. So what we're trying to do in Europe is try to stimulate an economic growth that is based on green growth.
The European Union has committed to cutting greenhouse gases by at least 20% and getting 20% of its energy from renewables by 2020. The goal is to try to keep global temperature rise to no more than 2 degrees Celsius. As Europe phases in its program for meeting those goals, arguments such as the tar sands issue and the fight over aviation emissions are likely to keep flaring up. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
The 2012 election race is heating up as candidates head toward races next week in Michigan and Arizona, followed by Super Tuesday's races in 10 states on March 6. Some of the nation's wealthiest individuals are giving millions to the politician of their choice. New data released from the Federal Election Commission shows a significant slice of super PAC donations are coming from the richest 1% of the 1%, and not all of that money is being spent in legal ways. The super PAC backing Mitt Romney was accused this week of violating federal election rules, but some campaign finance watchdogs predict little or no repercussions. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
By re-airing an ad on Thursday from Romney's 2008 bid for president, the super PAC backing him in the 2012 race may have broken federal law. Paul Ryan from the Campaign Legal Center explained why.
The legal problem for the super PAC Restore Our Future is that super PACs are prohibited from contributing to candidates. And their spending of money to republish an ad that was produced by the Romney campaign constitutes, for legal purposes, an illegal contribution from the super PAC to Romney.
Ryan says that FEC, which currently has 3 Democrat and 3 Republican members, is unlikely to fine Restore Our Future, as the agency has done little to enforce campaign finance laws over the last several years.
They certainly should, but recent history tells us that the FEC are more like cops sitting in the donut shop than cops on the beat.
And if they are fined, the Romney Super PAC can use some of the millions it's raised from donors to pay it. And a new report from the Campaign Legal Center found that many of the major donors to super PACs already gave the maximum amount to the candidate's campaign itself.
Those who are supporting the super PACs are really using them as an end run around the $2,500 candidate contribution limits. They max out to the candidate, but they have the capacity and the desire to keep giving, so they do so through these shadow campaign committee super PACs.
Romney's team had the most double-duty donors, as more than 80% of its super PAC backers had already given all they could to the campaign. But many of the donors to the super PACs for Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and President Obama did the same. This is technically legal, but Ryan says it undermines the Supreme Court's promise that the unlimited corporate spending allowed by the Citizens United decision would be independent from the campaigns. As advocate groups and some states mount legal challenges to Citizens United, the major donations keep rolling in. Billionaire casino CEO Sheldon Adelson gave Gingrich's Super PAC $10 million last month and told Forbes magazine he may give an additional $100 million. And on Thursday night, comedian Bill Maher jumped into the Super PAC game with a surprise announcement during his live show, Crazy Stupid Politics.
I would like to tonight announce a donation to the Obama Super PAC, which has the very unfortunate tongue twister name, Priority USA Action. But tonight, I would like to give that pack $1 million.
Maher presented the donation in the form of a giant novelty check. But Ari Berman, a political writer for The Nation, says not all Super PAC donations are given so publicly.
There are these organizations called 501c4s, which are nonprofit social welfare groups as designated by the IRS. And they can accept unlimited donations, but they don't have to disclose who they're coming from. So now we're seeing a situation where super PACs have sister arms that are 501c4s, and they're using the sister arms to mask where the money is coming from.
Analyzing the data from the PACs that are forced to disclose their donors, Berman found that just a handful of individuals are dominating the process.
It's not the 1%. It's not even the 1% of the 1%. It's actually the 0.00063%, because 80% of the money is coming from basically a group of 200 people. And if you drill down even further, it gets even more concentrated, because five people have given 25% of the money to super PACs. So an incredibly small number of people have a huge and disproportionate influence on the political process this time around.
Calling super PACs a threat to democracy, Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen introduced the Disclose Act of 2012 earlier this month. The bill would force all organizations involved in political campaigning to disclose their large donors, and would require that all political ads reveal what groups or corporations paid for them. A similar bill passed the House in 2010, but failed by just one vote in the Senate. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Online companies, including Twitter and Google, have drawn criticism from privacy advocates for tracking and gathering private data from users. Today, the Obama administration announced a privacy bill of rights that could increase transparency and give internet users easier ways to opt out of being tracked online. Since passing legislation in Congress is unlikely in an election year, officials are hoping companies will adopt the new rules voluntarily. But consumer advocates worry this will lead to watered-down protections. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
For many companies, more data is the key to profit. And without adequate laws regulating online privacy, consumers are being observed and analyzed in ways they may not approve of or understand. Chris Calabrese from the American Civil Liberties Union says current industry practices are troubling.
As you move about the internet, advertisers and other entities are tracking you. So they're learning when you visit a shopping website what things you browsed on. If you visit, you know, a news website, the sort of things that you're interested in. And then you may be served ads based on that. There'll be a profile created about you that suggests what your age is, what your political preference might be, all kinds of different information about you. And what a company does with that information is almost completely unregulated.
Complaints and lawsuits against the privacy violations of Google, Twitter, and other online companies prompted the Obama administration to draft a Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, which was made public Wednesday night. Commerce Secretary John Bryson says the blueprint lays out several key rights individuals should have when surfing the web.
Number one, individual control in what kinds of data companies collect. Transparency in how those companies plan to use that data. Respect for the context in which the data is provided and disclosed. Secure and responsible handling of that data. ability of consumers to access and ensure the accuracy of their own data, reasonable limits on the personal data that online companies try to collect and retain.
The administration invited both industry heads and consumer advocate groups to the table to craft these rules, which they hope to turn into a voluntary code of conduct and someday a bill in Congress. The Digital Advertising Alliance, which represents hundreds of online companies, also announced on Thursday that they are implementing a Do Not Track system. With one click, consumers will be able to easily opt out of having their online habits analyzed so that targeted ads can be sent to them. They are also promising not to share consumers' browsing data with non-advertising companies, such as employers making hiring decisions or insurers choosing who to approve for coverage. And the Federal Trade Commission has the right to enforce this commitment. But the ACLU's Calabrese says Do Not Track might not mean what consumers think it means.
It'll only be the receiving of ads. It won't be the tracking itself. So it's a good first step, but it's only a first step. And if they want a meaningful Do Not Track mechanism, it has to go further than just not serving them ads, but it has to go to actually not tracking them at all.
Despite the absence of strong online privacy protections, there are some ways consumers can protect themselves. Rainey Reitman with the Electronic Frontier Foundation described a few of them.
The Firefox browser offers several privacy protective add-ons that you can download. Among them, AdBlock Plus is a very powerful tool for stopping data collection by third-party advertisers with whom you don't have any relationship. And there's also an add-on called HTTPS Everywhere, which can help you have better privacy when you go along the Internet connecting to various sites.
Reitman says the details about sharing, accessing, and deleting data are usually buried in companies' long and confusing privacy policies, which few read or understand, and which can change even after consumers agree to them. Consumer advocates are also concerned that certain companies, including Twitter, Path, and Foursquare, use smartphone apps to download and store the contacts of users without their permission. After these practices were disclosed earlier this month, Path has promised to end the practice, and Twitter and other companies say they will clarify their policies. Several lawmakers are also urging the Federal Trade Commission to investigate Google for allegedly circumventing the privacy settings on the browser Safari. Many are also protesting Google's new privacy policy, including dozens of state attorneys general who said the changes are an invasion of privacy. The Electronic Privacy Information Center is suing the FTC to force it to block Google's new data sharing practices. If the court sides with the government or dismisses the case, Google will begin sharing personal data across its many products on March 1st without allowing users to opt out. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
A federal judge has ruled the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA, is unconstitutional and has ordered the government to provide benefits to the wife of a lesbian who is a federal employee. DOMA defines marriage as unions between opposite-sex couples and restricts the term spouse to mean only an opposite-sex partner. On Wednesday, Judge Jeffrey White of the U.S. District Court for Northern California ruled that the use of DOMA to ban benefits to a same-sex partner violates the right to equal protection under the law. The decision is the first since the Obama administration announced last year that it would no longer defend DOMA in court and could have implications for other ongoing cases across the country. For more, we're joined by John Davidson, legal director with Lambda Legal. That's the organization that argued the case. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
First, let's go over the details of this case. Karen Golinski is an attorney for the Ninth Circuit of Appeals, which makes her a federal employee. Her wife was denied health insurance benefits that other opposite-sex partners do receive. What did Judge White's ruling decide about this specific issue?
Well, Judge White ruled that the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution requires that the government have, at a minimum, a legitimate reason for treating similarly situated people differently. But he said that when it comes to sexual orientation discrimination, the burden should be on the government to justify discrimination, and that it should have to show at least an important reason for treating gay people unequally. he went through various factors that the Supreme Court has identified in prior cases about in what circumstances should court be suspicious that a differential treatment of a group of people that may be due to improper motives. And he looked at the issue of whether there had been a history of discrimination against gay people and said that that there really was no dispute as to that issue. He looked at the issue of whether or not the group being discriminated against has an equal ability to others to contribute to society, and he also said there really wasn't any dispute about that. He then looked at the issue of, well, was sexual orientation a defining or immutable characteristic, which is a factor courts have also looked at in trying to figure out, is the discrimination of a kind that seems particularly unfair and therefore is more questionable when the government is discriminating on that basis. And he said that the evidence that we had submitted showed that sexual orientation is highly resistant to change, and that the consensus in the scientific community is that it is an immutable characteristic.
As you go through the various points of Judge White's ruling, it really emerges as an extensive decision. One line that I'd like to highlight and get your response to is the line in the ruling where he states, quote, gay men and lesbians are a group deserving of heightened protection against the prejudices and power of an often antagonistic majority. What's the significance of having a line like that in this ruling?
Well, it's incredibly significant. With respect to most laws, you can presume that Congress has good reason for what it's doing, and that if it made a mistake, it would soon be fixed in the normal political process. But what Judge White recognized is that laws that discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation, well, we should be concerned about whether those are really legitimate or not, because there's been a long history of discrimination against people based on sexual orientation. So a law that does that might just be perpetuating discriminatory attitudes.
And how about the significance of this heightened protection, heightened scrutiny beyond DOMA?
Well, as a district court case, this really only applies in this case at the moment, though we hope it will be persuasive in other cases. But if affirmed on appeal, it would mean that any form of government discrimination, whether by the federal government or state or local government, would have to pass this high bar. The burden would be on the government for showing why it serves important government interests to treat gay people unequally.
And could that include influencing, for example, a Prop 8 trial, which we'll see another hearing?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. This really is an incredibly important step forward for the lesbian gay community across the country.
John Davidson is legal director with Lambda Legal. He joined us from Los Angeles. Thank you for your time.
Sure, it's great to speak with you.
In Argentina, residents continue their efforts to oppose copper and gold mining. On Thursday, several thousand anti-mining protesters shut down traffic in central Buenos Aires as they marched from the Plaza del Congreso to the historic Plaza de Mayo. They hope to put an end to what they view as destructive mining practices in the Argentine Andes. Ailish O'Neill reports.
Friend Cristina, the singer says, addressing the Argentine president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. We're not terrorists, we defend Famatina. Famatina is a town in the Argentine Andes. The Canadian Osisko Mining Company had planned gold exploration there, but it's paused operations in response to local protests. According to Claudius Erlan, a member of the Socialist Workers Movement, the people of Famatina learned from the experiences of other towns in the Andes.
There already are other confrontations in Argentina, like the Alumbrera, that haven't left anything to the people. That is, they haven't generated wealth or a better source of work. Instead, they've destroyed the environment. So with these examples, the people of Famatina oppose the mine.
The form of mining used to extract gold and copper from the Andes is la minería cielo abierto, or open pit mining. Maria Damasceno came to Thursday's rally because of her concerns about the environmental impacts of open pit mining techniques.
It's a very special kind of mining that's done by multinational corporations. What they're looking for is to, in very little time, cause a great deal of environmental harm in order to extract minerals, gold, lithium, other minerals. That brings a huge ecological problem because they destroy entire zones of the Andes.
Namaseno adds that open pit mining techniques require a huge amount of water and that they add contaminants to the soil. The protesters that gathered in Buenos Aires on Thursday hope to put an end to this form of mining throughout the Andes. Famatina, Andalgalá, the Andes, the speaker asks. They will not be touched, the protesters respond. Though the copper and gold mines are located in rural parts of the country, rally participant Nicolás Núñez says they affect all Argentines because contaminated rivers near the mines flow into the Río de la Plata, the river near Buenos Aires.
You can see the contamination in onion production, which is a vegetable that's eaten a lot in this country. Last year, they had to throw out all the onions from the San Juan province because you could see the onions were black because they were contaminated with cyanide.
The Canadian company Barrick Gold has had mining operations in San Juan since 2000. In fact, most of the mining companies operating in Argentina are based abroad. Enrique Viale, the president of the Argentine Association of Environmentalist Lawyers, says these companies represent a challenge to Argentina's sovereignty.
The transnational companies appropriate the territory. It even affects the credibility of democracy. In the provinces where there's this kind of mega mining, there's no division of power. All the power is in the service of mining capital.
Viale hopes that marching from the Plaza del Congreso to the Plaza de Mayo will have a symbolic effect.
In one is a legislative power, the Congress. In the other is the executive power, the president of the nation. So we bring our message to both powers, one so that it changes the laws, and the other so that it stops using mining as a model of, quote, development.
The Plaza de Mayo isn't just the location of the Casa Rosada, Argentina's executive mansion. It's also been the site of protests throughout the country's history, such as those against the military dictatorship of the late 1970s and early 1980s. Thursday's march to the plaza was just one in a series of anti-mining demonstrations that have been held across the country for several months. Continued protests are planned for early March. Ailish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
In Honduras, family members continue to demand answers after a prison fire killed more than 350 people. On Monday, relatives broke into a morgue demanding their loved ones' remains. Many Hondurans are also questioning a second fire that erupted over the weekend at the country's largest outdoor market in Tegucigalpa. No one was killed, but many vendors now lack a place to sell their goods. The fires are just the latest disasters to hit the country with the highest homicide rate in the world. Human rights in the country have declined since the 2009 coup, and one of the most violent regions is the Bajo Aguan. There, at least 64 farm workers, or campesinos, have been killed over the last 2 years because of complex land conflicts with the country's wealthiest landowner, Miguel Facuse. Over the weekend, more than 1,400 campesinos, indigenous people, and their allies met to continue their efforts to fight repression. From Tocoa, Honduras, FSRN's Tim Russo reports.
Hey!
activists organized the international gathering in solidarity with Honduras to expose the rampant violations of human rights and the systematic killing of campesinos. For months, campesinos have been struggling for land rights as agricultural corporations take over more land. The fight is centered around Miguel Facuse and his agrofuels Dinant Corporation, as well as the Standard Fruit Company. Speaking to the crowd, Melissa Cardosa, with the convergence of popular movements in the Americas, read from the gathering's declaration about the state of human rights in Honduras.
The war in Honduras has been furiously unleashed since the coup d'etat has manifested with assassination, persecution, the criminalization of organized actions, kidnappings, sexual violence towards women, intentional crimes that terrorize the children that live in the villages of campesinos in struggle, attacks against the grassroots media, imprisonment, exile, and lately, arson attacks against the distinct populations of the country.
One of the objectives of the gathering was to launch an international solidarity brigade which would observe human rights abuses in the Bajo Aguan region. In this vast valley, landowners like Facuse grow African palm, which is then processed and made into cooking oils and biodiesel. Consuela Castillas used to work on one of Facuse's African palm plantations. The middle-aged campesina, who was born in the Bajo Aguan, eventually began organizing with the Unified Campesino Movement of the Aguan, both to secure land rights and to fight for the health of workers. Castilla herself suffers from chronic asthma from years of working with toxic chemicals used in palm production. She says the threats against activists like herself have been increasing.
For approximately 8 months, there's been a continuous persecution by the private security forces of Miguel Facuse towards my house and my daughters, where they live in Corlazita. There's been a constant and daily monitoring of my daughters and a persecution towards them when they leave for school.
In addition to private security forces, the state military presence in Honduras and the Aguan specifically has increased since President Porfirio Lobo took office in 2010. Activists say this has increased the harassment of communities challenging the vast monocrop fiefdom run by Facuse. Salvador Zuniga works with the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. He says the death threats are an everyday occurrence for environmentalists and campesinos who inhabit many biologically diverse regions of Honduras.
I think that it's important that the world knows about the constant violation of human rights in our country continues and has become quite acute. It is good that people know about this, but also that they plan actions to be executed in defense of our human rights in a country that is becoming characterized by violence and repression, and in particular in the sector of Bajo Aguan, where a daily occurrence is the detention of men and women campesinos as well as their assassinations.
In addition to international human rights groups, some U.S. lawmakers have also expressed concerns about the violence in Honduras. Late last year, Congressmember Howard Berman wrote to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton expressing his concern about the systematic violations of human rights and killings of campesinos in Honduras. Berman and other lawmakers want the State Department to withhold military aid until human rights improve. But Annie Byrd, co-director of the Washington, D.C.-based Rights Action, says there has been little response from the Obama administration to the growing violence. She says that could be due to geopolitical interests and the expanding U.S. military presence in Honduras.
The U.S. has a very direct military presence in the Aguan and, of course, in Honduras in general. While it is true that the government of Honduras has completely collapsed, there's no justice system, the police are part of organized crime, the military is part of organized crime. You know, the conclusion that's being drawn from that is, well, then the U.S. needs to militarize more, have a direct military presence, the DEA acting directly in the region, and then also we need to create new police forces for Honduras, that the U.S. needs to do that, when that is absolutely the wrong answer to what's happening. More militarization will not change the situation or solve any problem.
The campesinos' fight for land rights is starting to achieve some results. Last Friday, a group of farm workers signed an agreement with President Porfirio Lobo, which would give land titles to campesinos for close to 20,000 acres of land over the next 15 years. But some have criticized the latest agreement, which includes a 6% interest rate on the payment of the lands. Activists are also demanding an end to detentions of labor leaders and the harassment of families. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tocoa, Honduras.
This weekend, Senegal is holding presidential elections. But some are concerned about rising tensions following months of protests, violence, and several deaths. Thousands demonstrated today to express their opposition to incumbent President Abdoulaye Wade, standing for a third term.
President Wade was supposed to be just the referee. And he's not supposed to run for the third time. We got to make sure that he's not going to win this election, otherwise he's going to steal it.
That was Matar Fall from the rap group Ion Ma, or Enough is Enough, protesting at a rally in Dakar. Today is the final day of campaigning for the 14 presidential candidates. Some of them say that Wade is trying to rig the elections, but Senegal's Constitutional Council says the president is not bound by a two-term limit because his first term began before the rule was introduced. The US and the EU have also expressed concerns about Wade's candidacy. FSRN's Alpha Jallo is in Dakar. With the election campaigns wrapping up today, Alpha, what's the situation on the streets of Dakar? Are there still rallies against Wade's candidacy?
Yes, there's still a big opposition to President Wade's candidacy. Yesterday there was a big riot, and this evening two main opposition parties are calling for a big rally because they said that there couldn't be any election in this country in which President Wade could participate. So they are calling on the people to come and protest to show that President Wade is not an eligible candidate. So there are also rallies taking place as we speak.
What has President Wade been saying in response to these repeated calls for him to withdraw his candidacy?
He has already made his position clear. He said that the elections will go ahead on Sunday, and no matter the amount of pressure that the opposition parties are making and the movement of June 23rd, that cannot just make sure that for him to cancel the elections. Yesterday, he held very big rallies in two suburbs of Dakar, Pikin and Gejowai, where they are too. He attacked the opposition, saying that they have no program. That's the reason why they resorted to violence. But he said that he's also about to organize a rally today. Now, not actually in downtown Dakar, but very close to downtown Dakar, because he'll be holding rallies in Medina and other localities within Dakar.
There are 13 other presidential candidates. Two of the main contenders are Macky Sall and Idrissa Seck, who are both former prime ministers who served under Wade. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
For Macky Sall, I think he is somebody who has a very light followers, Macky Sall, because as you know, that most of these parties, opposition parties and the M23 movement are calling for the cancellation of the elections. But Macky Sall is saying no. He said that the election must go ahead as planned, and the opposition parties should come together to make sure that they are going to defeat President Wade. Even yesterday, Macky held a big rally in outside the country and just in the hinterland. But there he also invited the Senegalese musical star Youssou Ndour to join forces with him, because he said that's the only way they can defeat President Wade. As for Idrissa Seck himself, he's still around. He's still in Dakar. Yesterday, he made several attempts to reach Independence Square, but then the police always chase him. He's around. He said that the reason why Wade is want to go ahead with the election is that because they have plans to rig the election. But they are other things happening, because just a spokesman of President Wade said, very strong accusation indeed. He said that Idrissa Seck has hired many mercenaries here in Senegal from neighboring countries. They are all in Senegal ready just to disrupt the Sunday poll. These are very strong accusations. Well, Idrissa Seck has not responded so far, so maybe in the next coming hours he will respond regarding to those serious allegations.
Apart from these controversies and the main controversy of Wade's candidacy for a third time, what are some other important issues in this election?
Yesterday I was in downtown Dakar, and I was speaking to people, so many people. Now, in the last couple of days, people have been running to these voter registration centers trying to get their voters' card. In fact, the EU has also even raised concern about that. So many people have not yet received their voters' card. That means they are not going to vote in Sunday's polls. A lot of the opposition parties are angry, saying that now it's the government, it's a ploy by the government to make sure that they have not released voter cards to their owners so that people can go to vote. So this is also something that is really hampering the election, because if you go to some localities outside Dakar, about 15% of those who have registered have not yet received their voter registration cards.
Alpha Jallo, FSRN's correspondent in Dakar, Senegal, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Denny.
And thank you to FSRN for that lengthy news broadcast. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And that's our program for Friday, February 24th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more independent news, join us on Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee. Today's show was produced by me. And from the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. And just a reminder, school does commence on Monday for all you UBC students dutifully listening to News 101. So enjoy your last few days of freedom, and don't forget to tune in Monday and Friday, 5 p.m. for more independent news. Stay tuned for Stranded after these PSAs.
Stanley G. Grizzle was born in 1918 in Toronto. As a leader in the Canadian Pacific Railroad Porters Union, Grizzle was instrumental in communicating information and advice from coast to coast. Grizzle and other porters on layover would contact local Black communities and help them to understand that their experiences were part of a broader pattern, and they would offer specific tactical suggestions for change. The Porters Union made alliances with other Canadian movements. Their ambition? To mobilize a concerted demand upon governments for legislative change.